Chapter 11. The Big House. At length the harvest was gathered. The barn was filled with hay and oats, and in the high-fenced lot behind it there were three or four huge stacks of wheat waiting for the time of thrashing. The corn had been laid by, that is, it had received its last ploughing, and the pumpkins were growing yellow in the field. There were peaches in the orchard and a great surplus of early apples. On every hand there was plenty of everything, even plenty of work for every member of the family. "Now we must finish the new house," said Father. "The frame has been standing unenclosed so long that I am ashamed. If all of us do what we can, we may get everything finished before the next quarterly meeting, and what a satisfaction it will be to be able to entertain friends in a suitable manner." All hands, therefore, were put to the work. From daylight till dark, 6 days in the week, we could hear nothing but the sound of hammers and saws and planes and augers. Father was a skillful carpenter. He had built more houses and barns than any other man in the new settlement, if not in the whole world. The big boys, David and Jonathan, were willing and strong and quick to do whatever task was set for them. And I, small as I was, had my own part to perform, running errands, carrying shingles and nails and bricks, and helping my seniors in a thousand ways. There was little time for reading in those busy days, but I kept my parley book on the unused end of Father's workbench, and whenever I could catch a moment's leisure, I turned to its pages for solace and delight. Sometimes I would ask Father the meaning of an unusual word or expression, and sometimes he would pause in the midst of his work and explain whole passages that were perplexing to me. And thus, my dear Leonidas, in 1 month's time, I learned more geography than you, with all your opportunity and modern methods, will have learned in 2 years of schooling. It was another red-letter day when the finishing touches were put upon the big house, as we thereafter called it, and it was pronounced ready for occupancy. You may smile at the idea of calling it a big house, for it was only 20 feet long and not quite so broad, but to me it seemed a very spacious dwelling, as commodious as a meeting house and as elegant as a king's palace. 2/3 of the floor space was given up to the settin' room, and the remainder was divided equally into 2 very small bedrooms. At one end of the settin' room there was a diminutive fireplace, and a chimney built of home-burned bricks, neatly laid and painted red. For Father, in addition to his other pursuits, was a brickmaker, a mason, and a painter. On each side of the house there was a door with a window close by, and at the farther end there were 2 tiny windows, one for each of the bedrooms. The entire arrangement was so perfect that none of us could imagine any way to improve upon it. And now the work of furnishing the big house was begun with great zest and delight on the part of all. 6 brand new Windsor chairs, which Father had made in the winter months, were brought from their place of storage in the shop and ranged in a stiff, prim row along the back wall of the settin' room. A big rocking chair was set facing them on the opposite side to keep them in order when they were left to themselves. A 3-legged candle stand, which Jonathan claimed as his own handiwork, was set beside the south window, and a little looking glass with a red frame and the picture of a tiny white house at the top was hung on the opposite wall. A Seth Thomas clock with wooden wheels, which Mother had for years kept safely stored in the big chest in the loft, waiting for a suitable place and occasion like the present, was brought out and burnished and set to going. And then, to our great admiration, it was put exactly in the middle of the mantelpiece above the little fireplace. A last year's almanac also was laid on the mantel shelf, and a many-colored hussif, housewife, full of thread and needles and buttons, was hung by the chimney corner. This completed the furnishing of the settin' room. The 2 bedrooms were fitted out each exactly alike, each with a bed and a chair, and it was here that the artistic skill of Cousin Mandy Jane and Cousin Sally were exhibited to the full. For the latter, as an expert in all matters of household economy, had been invited to come over and help fix up. The bedsteads were very high with elaborately turned posts the tops of which touched the ceiling. Father took great interest in seeing them set up, for he, with Jonathan, had spent many a long winter evening in shaping and framing them. Instead of bed springs, there was a network of ropes upon which the bed was made up, and the making up was in the following order. First, the straw tick, a sort of mattress filled with clean wheat straw. Second, the feather tick, a huge bag stuffed with feathers from our own ducks and geese. Third, a pair of snow-white linen sheets made of flax grown in our own field, spun, woven, bleached, and hemmed by our own womenfolk. Fourth, another feather tick, called the kiver tick, not so heavy as the first, and wonderfully soft and soothing. Over this last was spread a white blanket, made of wool from our own lambs. And then, capping the whole, there was a patchwork quilt composed of hundreds of bits and samples of calico and gingham and linsey-woolsey, the gatherings of years from every imaginable and available source. When the bed was completely made up, it was so high that Cousin Sally had to stand on her tiptoes to reach to the top of it. Finally, two huge feather pillars were laid at the head, on top of this mountain of repose, and a valance of figured pink calico was stretched from post to post between the straw tick and the floor. "Now just come and look at it," said Cousin Sally. "It's just fine enough for a queen to lay on." The whole family assembled to admire this triumph in the bed-making art, and every voice was loud in its praises. "Now," said Father, in tones of deepest satisfaction, "we are in a condition to accommodate traveling friends decently and becomingly." "It would be nice if we only had a little looking-glass to hang in each bedroom," suggested Cousin Mattie Jane. "Then the women could see how to fix their hair when they get up in the morning." "No such thing is necessary," remarked Father. "If they want to see themselves, they can go out and use the glass that hangs in the settin' room. We won't pander to anybody's vanity." "I've heard tell," said Cousin Sally, "that in some of the fine houses in Wayne, they put a tin of water and a washpan in each bedroom so that the women can wash their faces and hands when they get up. I think that's pretty nice." "It's nice enough for quality folks," said Mother, "but common folks don't need any such conveniences. The friends that lodge with us can go out to the kitchen bucket or down to the spring branch to wash theirselves. It won't hurt 'em to do like we do." "That's right, Mother," said David. "If they're too good to do like common folks, let 'em go without washing, I say." The beds were padded and smoothed and padded and smoothed. The chairs were rearranged against the wall. The floor was swept and garnished. The walls were dusted, and the hearth was mopped and polished. Then Cousin Sally brought in two cracked Cheney cups, each containing a posy of marigolds and sweet williams. "I'll set one of these on the window sill in each bedroom," she said. "They'll kinder match the quilts and make things cheerful and sweet-smellin'." Finally, Cousin Mandy Jane brought in an armload of green sprigs of sparrowgrass, which she arranged with great skill and taste in the little brick fireplace. "Well, now," she said, standing back and admiring her work, "I just think it's as purty as a picture and right smart more useful." "Yes," added Cousin Sally, "it can't be beat nowhere in the new settlement." Every excuse was made for prolonging the work of furnishing and decorating, but at length it was pronounced completed. The skill of womankind could do no more. Then all of us went out, and although the doors and windows were left open to admit the sunshine and the soft breezes, it was distinctly understood that, except in cases of real necessity, none of us should again venture to set foot within the hallowed precincts. The big house was altogether too fine for everyday use. It was to remain sacredly unoccupied until the advent of honored company, or of friends from abroad, should make its reopening desirable and proper.